Good morning. A paper out today takes a different look at the dredging of atolls in the South China Sea, and it's all about the reefs. We'll talk with UH professor and lead author Camilo Mora. Homeless people released from hospital who are too frail to go back on the street will have a place of respite. Jerry Coffey from the Institute of Human Services joins us. And with Waikiki continuing to morph, what's the effect on the community? Christopher McNally, Chaminade Professor of Political Economy, weighs in. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Some 67 nuclear bombs were detonated in the Marshall Islands in the early 50s, and their after effects are still being understood. We'll talk with Dr. David Krieger, president of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. And April is National Poetry Month. It's being celebrated on Maui with a Merwin Conservancy Green Room visit from Chancellor of the Academy of American Poets, Jane Hirschfield.
That's the conversation. Now the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
A couple of conversations this morning about South Pacific Islands, yeah?
Right, for very, very different reasons.
Yeah.
So we're going to start with this first one. Now, if you mention the South China Sea, you might think international politics. But today, University of Hawaii researchers want you to think coral reefs. A paper published in the open access journal PLOS Biology documents reef dredging and land creation in the South China Sea to the detriment of coral reefs. The authors of the paper used remote sensing data from the Landsat 8 operational land imager to look at the destruction and land reclamation of seven atolls in the Spratly Islands. Professor Camilo Mora, lead author of the paper, joins us now in our studio. Good morning. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Every time we sort of hear South China Sea, there seems to be this knee-jerk reaction to jump to politics. You're really asking us to look at this from a very different perspective in terms of what we may be losing ecologically. What specifically do you see incredibly threatened?
Well, unfortunately, I think that those atolls are there are seven atolls there that right now are completely gone. There's just no way, given our biological understanding of the systems, that they will ever recover. The reason for that is that this activity of dredging is killing the corals directly and putting them on top of the islands to fill up the islands. Unfortunately, that generates a lot of sediments that prevents the corals coming back. So we have very good experiences from the past suggesting that it will take hundreds of years for these coral reefs to recover. Unfortunately, once you bring ecology into the equation, you realize that what they are doing, the Chinese there, is not really smart at all. Because what they are doing there is by killing the corals. The corals are the things that are keeping alive, afloat, those islands. So as you kill the corals, those islands are going to be sinking, meaning that now for those islands to keep afloat, the Chinese had to start dumping more sand on top of those islands. So this is going to be a process that is going to be very expensive, and unfortunately, it's just going to cause the destruction of those coral reefs. For me, that's very worrisome because right now we have many islands just like this in which many countries are claiming ownership over those islands. And the only way that they can claim ownership over the islands is by going and filling them up to build up buildings there. So it could generate a race to the destruction of these ecosystems. And today, in this time and age, it's just heartbreaking to see how is it that humanity is allowing the destruction of these ecosystems when you can actually see this from space now. This is not like climate change that you can make your mind because you don't see it. But here, we are actually seeing this stuff from satellite images.
When you look at this, what kind of analogy would you make to lay people who might say, okay, so you're dredging an island and you may kill some corals. It's out in the middle of nowhere. Why should they care?
So the analogy that I make, this is like a jewel, a diamond, the most expensive diamond that you can think of, put it on a bench and hammer it with a hammer, smash it with a hammer. That's the analogy that I make here because these coral reefs, they are jewels in themselves in the sense that they are very unique. It had taken millions of years of evolution for those coral reefs to get there. Now that they have been destroyed, they can never be restored. right? So this is the analogy with the diamond. Is once you crack the diamond, there is just no way you can put it back together. So something that was very unique has been forever destroyed.
That's a pretty intense analogy, and hits home for people, I'm sure, in many ways, to think about not being able to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, or a jewel, or anything that is precious. As you say that it's been so destroyed, what impetus then would there be to stop the race of all these countries who want to claim it, from, you know, Taiwan on down, the Philippines, etc., to be able to safeguard the rest of them?
Well, I think that we're in a very good situation right now if we act right now. Again, once those atolls get destroyed, there is just nothing we can do there. But today we have many more atolls that can be saved from this pathway. And I think that we had a very good opportunity today. Fortunately for us, many of those atolls are within the areas of ownership of many countries. So that's the reason why there are disputes, is because many countries can claim ownership over those places. So right now, those places legally don't belong to anybody. So I think that we can potentially use the same argument, is this doesn't belong to anybody, so it's going to belong to everybody. And the way to do that is to set up a protected area on the whole place. This is going to belong to the humanity. This is like putting that jewel that we're talking about in a museum for future generations to enjoy. So we had a very good precedent that this is possible of doing, setting up a huge protected area there. And the precedent that we had is Antarctica. Back in the day, Antarctica was used to be claimed by many countries. The international community came together and they say, no, we are not going to race to colonize that place. What we are going to do is to protect this. And now Antarctica is a multinational protected area that belongs to humanity. We can potentially do the same thing there and prevent all of those jewels of being destroyed.
How do you expect the international community to rally around and do that differently when you're coming up against China?
Well, to be honest with you, I think that China needs to put China. There is not a planet called China. There is not a planet called United States. There is a planet called Earth. This belongs to everybody. So the Chinese destroying this stuff is destroying something that belongs to them as well. So I think that once we come with common sense, I'm hoping that common sense will prevail on this kind of stuff. And to be honest with you, I think the problem so far has been that we have been focusing too much on the politics. And unfortunately, politics is about showing who is the strongest, who has the biggest army. But once you realize that these are very fragile ecosystems, I'm hoping that it will appeal to the sensitivity of people that this is not the right thing to do.
Within the community of scientists in which you interact, what kind of movements are you seeing to have that kind of general and international movement?
No, unfortunately, that's kind of the thing that is the saddest. Is that a scientist? Sorry to my colleagues, but we are very afraid people. You know, we don't like to engage on controversial situations, which is an unfortunate thing for society overall, because we are the ones studying this stuff, but we are afraid of stepping up to face the politicians and the criticism that comes from this stuff. Unfortunately, this is a good example of that. Right now, there are a lot of international initiatives on that area to protect all of those coral reefs. It's the most diverse place in the planet, all of that triangle there. And unfortunately, those spratly islands were removed from those conservation efforts just because they wanted to avoid the potential confrontation with China. And I have even contacted Chinese friends, colleagues of mine, to endorse this paper, you know. And they all say, no, I love my career too much to get into a situation with this. So I don't think we can expect much from the scientists, to be honest with you. There might be a few people in the scientific community that will be brave enough to engage in this debate, but I don't think we can expect that. I think that what we need to do is, as a society, to move forward.
That doesn't sound terribly hopeful, but perhaps there will be others who will take up the cause. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Dr. Camilo Mora is an assistant professor at UH Manoa. He's the lead author of research projects on the magnitude and impacts of climate change on people and species. He's also a reviewer for publications including Science, National Geographic, and Nature Climate Change. The paper on the dredging of the South China Sea is out today in the journal PLOS Biology. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's now 8:13. Coming up, a documentary about the effects of nuclear testing in the South Pacific. But first, testing your backyard quiz.
With the high surf advisory in effect today, our backyard quiz takes us to one of Hawaii's most famous big wave surf spots, Waimea Bay. It's on the north shore of Oahu, as you know, and it attracts thousands of visitors and residents each year. Some of the world's most audacious surfers flock there annually to push their limits in some of the biggest surf Hawaii has to offer. This was not always the case, though. For years, surfers considered the waves at Waimea too big to ride and later believed the bay to be cursed. The beliefs stemmed from the death of one of the first surfers who tried to surf at Waimea. If you can tell us the name of this surfer who was lost at Waimea in the early days of modern surfing, you'll be today's winner. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Hi, good morning. I'm Hong Jiang from NTD Chinese Language TV Station. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
Americans have yet to understand the full impact of the nuclear testing that was conducted in the Marshall Islands in the early 1950s or of its genocidal after effects. It's a lot to take in, especially for the people of a country that styles itself as a moral leader, but it's not something that can be ignored. Maui Peace Action and the Maui Hiroshima Nagasaki Remembrance Committee are showing a documentary later this month called Nuclear Savage, The Islands of Secret Project 4.1. David Krieger is the president of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, and he joins us by phone this morning. Good morning, Dr. Krieger.
Good morning.
What's the best way to sum up the full what was done there?
I think the best way is to look to the extreme arrogance of the United States officials who were conducting the nuclear tests in the Marshall Islands, and the policies of the United States were extremely detrimental to the people of the Marshall Islands, who suffered horrendously. So it's an important film to realize what kind of extreme arrogance was going on in the early days of the nuclear age.
Well, the arrogance is kind of a given once you know the facts, Dr. Krieger. What are the numbers of devices that were detonated?
There were 67 nuclear tests that took place in the Marshall Islands between 1946 and 1958, and those tests had an equivalent power of exploding 1.6 Hiroshima-sized bombs. Daily for that entire 12-year period.
How much did we know when we, the United States, know about after effects when this was done?
Well, we knew that radiation is dangerous and causes serious problems to human health and well-being, but we were trying to find out more. At the time, we were using animal experiments and I think also experiments on the people of the Marshall Islands.
The data previous to the Marshall Islands testing basically came from what was happening to the people who survived the initial bombings in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, right?
That's That's correct.
But we still didn't know that much when we went ahead and detonated.
You know, we were the only country that had nuclear weapons at that time in 1946 when we began testing. So we were really in an arms race with ourselves as we were testing and trying to figure out the effects on human beings.
Well, I'm not trying to justify it, David, but it was a very tense time in which we had just come out of the Second World War with an immediate concern about what the Soviet Union was going to do, right? And they were moving pretty rapidly toward getting nuclear devices. So I'm not excusing it, but I'm saying that there was a kind
they,
of...
They thought, the United States officials, including Harry Truman at that time, thought it would take the Soviet Union 20 years to develop a nuclear weapon. They turned out to be wrong, but, you know, that still doesn't excuse using nuclear weapons on a human population. With the surrounding human population, as we did. We thought it was a remote place, perhaps, but still, those people had no had human rights and shouldn't have been used as guinea pigs in nuclear experiments.
No, of course not, Dr. Krieger. I'm not attempting to excuse it. I'm attempting to understand the rationale from the official point of view as to why it was done. And of course it was rather cynically inflicted on a non-white distant population, yeah?
Absolutely. I mean, the testing wasn't done near populated areas in the United States for a good reason.
Yeah.
And it wasn't necessarily a good reason that we did it on islanders in the mid-Pacific. We've caused them untold grief and health problems that extend to today.
No, I understand that. I'm sort of trying to sort of assemble the information, particularly the new this documentary Nuclear Savage has some newly declassified information. Is that right?
That's what I understand. The filmmaker has been adding information to the film, but as I understand it, there was something policy that was called 4.1, and it actually talked about human experimentation. That was actually the plan of the government to test the weapons and see what would happen with the humans that were in the vicinity of the tests.
So we really went into this without knowing much about what it was going to do to the, knowing much or caring much about what it was going to do to the people of the Marshall Islands.
Well, I think we had an idea that it wasn't going to be something that they would be thanking us for down the road.
I can't imagine, though, that either. Thank you very much, Dr. Krieger. I appreciate you taking the time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
David Krieger is the president of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. He'll be at a free screening of the documentary Nuclear Savage, the Islands of Secret Project 4.1 at the Wailuku Library at 5:30 on Thursday, April 14th. The screening is sponsored by Maui Peace Action and the Maui Hiroshima Nagasaki Remembrance Committee.
Trump's not-so-exclusive club.
I would rather see Japan having some form of defense and maybe even offense against North Korea, because we're not pulling the trigger. We can't afford it.
Go forth and proliferate, says the Donald, while Obama leads an effort to put potentially mobile nuclear materials in a lockbox. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and Public Radio International.
this morning at 9, right after the conversation.
You love HPR. You listen all the time. You're a true radiophile. Signal the depth of your feeling with a personal gift of support. Mahalo to Ann Vernig of Honolulu, Christopher Dennis of Pukalani, and Robert and Kathy Lindsay of Kamuela for their recent gifts. Early initiative on your part can mean fewer fundraising interruptions in the future. Call us at 955-8821 during business hours, or you can give online at hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks. It's an easy as an app with a different business model and different rules, and that's just why taxi companies don't like ride services, Uber and Lyft. Now with bills moving in the Honolulu City Council and the legislature, there's again a push to regulate Uber and Lyft the same as taxis. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, there's no love lost between either group, and we've talked about this for such a long time. This particular run at it, though, has some differences, and we'll just say it flat out, Frankenstein bills.
So we had two reporters team up to do this story, Anita Hofschneider, who covers the city, and Nathan Eagle, who covers the Capitol. And so just quickly, let me just recap. Tomorrow, Friday, in Senator Roz Baker's committee, there's a bill that was revived, like Frankenstein, brought to life, a gut and replace, that would essentially place some insurance requirements on taxi-type companies like Uber and Lyft. And so that bill is tomorrow. And then, of course, the city council has another bill of its own that is going to be – deferred. It was heard yesterday in the budget committee, heated two-hour discussion. That's not till the end of the month now when they decide. But that bill actually has some – other requirements. But basically, the bottom line is Uber and Lyft say this is not fair. We have, as you mentioned, we have a very different business model than taxi companies. But taxi companies say, look, you're coming into our market and you're not having to abide by the same rules. So it is up to, it appears now, our lawmakers to settle the situation
and figure out whether this is a turf war or whether this is a matter of fairness.
Right. And the people for Uber that we heard from say that they're willing to abide by some regulations. But look, they're very different. They don't want to put a sign on top of their car, for example, saying we are Uber, right? Then you would look just like Charlie's Taxis or something like that. They're also concerned about replacing the GPS device that's used to calculate fares, replace that with a taxi meter, which, of course, is what taxis use. And if anyone's ever sat in a taxi, they've seen how quickly those things rack up the fees. So there's concerns about that. There's other requirements as well. And I'm talking specifically about the city council bill, not the Capitol bill. But another thing would require the Uber drivers, Lyft drivers, to pass an exam showing that they can get around Honolulu, some medical standards they have to meet. So these are the kind of things that Uber says, look, we're a private company. We have part-time workers. Don't make us do this. Otherwise, and they're quite serious about this, they're going to leave the Honolulu market, the Hawaii market.
And we've seen them leave other places, Oregon, for example.
Right. And there is a lot of money at play. Both sides are retaining a lobbyist, including like one of the top lobbyists in town, involving Red Morris and John Radcliffe and Bruce Coppa. And interestingly enough, Dale Evans, the head of Charlie's Taxis, longtime friend of Ann Kobayashi, who's the chair of the budget committee. Well, guess what? Once that bill was introduced in the council by Ernie Martin, a donation appeared both in Martin's campaign fund and Ann Kobayashi's fund from Dale Evans. Probably just a coincidence.
Well, but did she recuse herself at all?
No, she did not. She is chair of the budget committee and is saying, oh, donations don't influence me. But that certainly raises some concerns. But this is really coming down, I think, fundamentally, the reality check here is what's best for the consumer. What is in our interest? And as you can see, more and more people are choosing Uber and Lyft type services because they say it's cheaper, more convenient. And we'll see how this plays out all within the next month.
Right. It's less nerve-wracking as people are watching or not having to watch that meter. Thanks very much, Chad. We'll talk to you tomorrow. Chad Blair joins us daily for Reality Check.
Good morning. It's 8:28, and you're tuned to The Conversation on Statewide, member-supported HPR2. I'm Chris Vandercook. You can reach us at Hawaii Public Radio in several different ways. Our talkback line is 808-792-8217. We're on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or on Twitter at HI Conversation. Email is talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up, a place of respite for the homeless, the changing face of Waikiki, and later, a poet and essayist looks at the ways a poem can change the world. After the news from Deutsche Welle.
That's a look at international news. Today in Hawaii, medically frail and homeless patients released from hospital will have a place to go that's not back to the streets. A public-private partnership between a new nonprofit, Home Aid Hawaii, and Queens Medical Center is making that possible. The Institute for Human Services will operate the 8-bed short-term home care facility. IHS Clinical Director Jerry Coffey is in our studio now. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
Now, we hear 8 beds, but for those 8 people who are coming out of hospital and have no place to go, that is going to be a place of refuge. What defines a medically frail individual coming out of hospital who would be eligible for this?
That's a good question. So, under normal circumstances, for folks who have a home, when we leave the hospital, oftentimes there'll be home health services that would follow us home. Home health agencies, they come into our homes and they provide skilled nursing and in some cases non-skilled services, which make it possible for us to fully recover. And so that course of recovery, often there's follow-up appointments and there's services that are provided to us in our homes, and it really makes it possible for that chronic health condition to resolve. Homeless folks don't obviously have that option. So Tutu Burt's House is now an option for those folks to go and complete what for a lot of them is IV antibiotic infusion therapy or infusion treatment. Diabetes is a very common chronic health condition for homeless folks. Cellulitis is the breakdown of our skin. That often becomes infected. And what Queens and IHS have known for a long time is that there is a definite vicious cycle for folks going back to the street prior to that medical condition having fully resolved, back into the ER and back into an inpatient hospital bed. And we've worked for many years to try to put together a discharge for folks like this that makes sense.
So this would be taxing for the person who has to go back into the ER, back into a hospital bed. It's certainly very costly. Have you estimated how much that will cost annually?
We've been talking story with Queens, and the estimate at this point is just about $3 million savings for Queens. And that doesn't include what Medicaid health plans also are paying to manage these chronic health conditions. Medicaid, of course, is code for our tax dollars. That's money that could obviously be better spent in other places.
Now, this particular facility is not something that's going to be publicly known because it's for people who need to be getting well, but the conduit to that is going to come through Queens Medical Center.
That's correct. At the moment, those beds belong to Queens, and you know, in an average week, I clear between 5 and 10 hospital referrals that come from any number of hospitals directly into our shelter. Those folks are coming from psych beds. They're coming from inpatient hospital beds and also from the emergency room. So Tutu Burt's House is now an alternative to people going to the street. And often Queens is really stuck. Most hospitals are stuck because an individual's level of care needs are beyond what we can manage in an emergency shelter. And there's a great deal of cost associated with folks who...
Right, and they're trying to simply get them out when they feel that they are medically able to be out of the hospital
That's
bed.
Correct.
But there's that disconnect between can they, in fact, reconnect to their lives. It's named Tutu Burt's House, we should say.
Thank you for asking. So Claude Dutiel, most folks by now understand, was the founder of IHS. And Claude's wife, Alberta, she's now living on the mainland. Alberta, or Burt, and her son Duke are very much involved with and stay abreast of what we're doing, and they get back to the islands. Their roots are here. I'm happy to say that Tutu Burt is on the island today. Today's our grand opening and our blessing for Tutu Burt's House. So I'm literally leaving here and going straight there to give her a big fat hug. It felt appropriate that we would name this medical step-down facility Tutu Burt's House.
Well, we wish you all the best with it, and for those people who will be fortunate enough to move through it, a healthful life afterward. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Jerry Coffey is the clinical director for Hawaii's largest and oldest emergency homeless shelter, the Institute for Human Services. Now, later tonight on Town Square, we're going to be taking a look at where we are with homelessness right now as we are moving toward the end of session, just about a little more than a month to go. We're going to get updates from Mark Gannon, who is now chair of Partners in Care, Scott Morishige, the state homelessness coordinator, and Maud Cumming, who is Bridging the Gap chair. That's the sort of the Neighbor Island counterpart to Partners in Care. Also, the Reverend David Gerlach will be joining us from St. Elizabeth's Episcopal Church. And Chris, you know, looking at where we are with all this, as we started the session where homelessness was on everybody's lips, the question is, how do we see this progressing? What are the takeaways from where we've gone in the last couple of months with the session?
Well, one of the ways in which it's progressing, Beth Ann, is I can remember covering this issue in the 80s when Reverend Dutil and IHS were pretty much the only game in town. And there wasn't nearly as widespread attention to the issue as there is now. So that's progress of a sort, yeah.
Progress, but you know, to talk to some of the providers and outreach service workers trying to be able to network that, and they've been able to do that with a standard instrument now when they go out to talk to people who are homeless. But looking at what do we do, when we look at the numbers, can we really do something about ending homelessness? I mean, certainly we've done made great strides with veteran homelessness, and everybody else too would be nice.
The whole notion of ending it seems unlikely.
Well, we'll see how well we think we're doing, at least our panel tonight at 5 on Town Square, and we hope you'll plan to join us then. If you've lived in Waikiki for a number of years, no one has to tell you that the area has changed. Now, beyond beautification, hotel ownership has helped define the character of Waikiki, and now that could be changing in the bidding war for Starwood Hotels and Resorts. Both Marriott and a Chinese insurance mogul want the company. Unrelated to that, there's also the plan to build a 350-foot tower on what's now the low-rise King's Village property. So how might these proposed changes affect the community? Chaminade University political economy professor Chris McNally is also adjunct senior fellow at the East-West Center, and he has some thoughts. He's on the phone with us now. Welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
As you're seeing what has happened in Hawaii and what has happened specifically in Waikiki over the last, say, 10 years or so, how do you characterize how the community has been responding?
Well, I'm not a specialist, actually, on, you know, the Waikiki community. What I know about is the Chinese political economy has been booming despite a slowdown in recent years. The service sector in particular has been developing very, very rapidly. And as a result, outbound tourism from China now has become the biggest in the world. So the Chinese have actually become the biggest tourism aficionados, and Hawaii is clearly on their map, and one can see that in terms of Chinese tourist arrivals. But this is just the beginning. It's likely that over the next decade, Chinese tourist arrivals are going to continue to boom, especially towards Hawaii, and Waikiki is going to be transformed once more because of that.
When you say transformed in the people that we see walking around there, or transformed in terms of increased ownership by Chinese nationals?
Well, both is going to happen. The Chinese have been quite active as investors over the past 5 to 10 years. This is one of the biggest deals. This is Ambang. It's an insurance company that is sitting on a big pile of cash and wants to put it to use. It's actually not a hotel operator like Marriott, but they do have enough financial firepower to take over Starwood Hotels and are likely to manage it in a relatively stable way. So they are unlikely to behave like private equity investors when they took over the Hilton Group and tried to restructure a lot of things, do a lot of cost cutting. It's more likely that it will be steady as she goes. But overall, Hawaii will see much greater investment by Chinese. We also saw that over in Ko'olina with the purchase of a property by a Chinese funded concern. And we'll also see much more investment in non-Waikiki hotel properties. So Ko'olina is a good example of this. But as the rail line is built, we're still not quite sure, but it probably will be built into the city, it's likely that Chinese investors will be eagerly seeking properties along rail stations to build up hotels for the mass market Chinese tourists. Because for them, Waikiki is still very, very expensive. Even the lower price properties are quite dear.
You talk a lot about the nature and logic of China's capitalist transition. And in so doing, what do you see that's particularly different about the way Chinese investors go about putting their money someplace versus the way perhaps other people do, particularly Americans?
Well, the situation is quite different in the sense that there are a lot of Chinese companies, large companies, that A, do have a lot of financial firepower. They have a lot of cash on hand. B, they are seeking to diversify. They are seeking to go beyond the product lines within which they've been active so far. And C, they really do like big American companies. So several years back, Dalian Wanda, which is a big commercial real estate developer in China, bought the AMC theater chain, the movie theater chain. And they have been doing other forays into movie studios and the production of films. Ambang is another example. This is though a more state-owned concern that has a lot of cash on hand and is seeking to diversify in this sense into tourism properties, into hotels. And we're going to continue to see a lot of this. It's a bit similar to the Japanese in the late 1980s, but the Chinese tend to be more discerning. They tend to be slower going, and they tend to pick actually properties and investment options that will provide a long-term return.
Does that mean then, you know, building much more highly dense properties?
Well, there are zoning restrictions, et cetera, in Waikiki, so it's going to be interesting to see how this is going to play out. Waikiki itself actually doesn't have that much space left. But certainly they will be seeking to build more properties and expand. And where I'm seeing it happening is probably less so in Waikiki and more so in areas along the rail line and also out into Kualina, where there is more space to build new properties that have lower prices.
Lower prices meaning what?
Well, the Chinese tourism sector is really quite fascinating. It's very segmented. You have high-end tourists that will be staying in the Starwood properties and other properties like the Four Seasons, higher-end places. And then you have a very large mass tourist that does not like to spend a lot of money on hotels. They spend a lot of money on shopping. They spend a lot of money on little tours and things like that. But they do not tend to stay in high-end properties, rather kind of mass-market properties that you will be charging between $100 and $200 a night. Now, there is not that much of that in Waikiki itself. Indeed, on the whole island of Oahu and other islands, there are not that many properties in that price range. So it looks likely that Chinese will trend to develop both the very high end as well as this more lower middle end segment of the hotel market.
And if that 350-foot tower goes up where the King's Village is now, and that's not necessarily Chinese-owned per se, but do you think that that will be an attractive situation for some of those folks who are Chinese and looking for lower-end properties that will include a high-density model?
Yes, for sure. And overall, we do have a bit of a shortage of hotel rooms, especially if you project into the future Chinese tourist arrivals. You know what's been happening over the past year, and you project that into the future. At some point, the Chinese are going to overtake the Japanese, and we'll get like over a million tourist arrivals from China. And we just don't have the infrastructure at the moment, not just in terms of hotel rooms, but also in terms of many other facilities.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there for the moment. Thanks so much for joining us. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you, Bethann. Goodbye.
Christopher McNally is a professor of political economy at Chaminade University. He's also an adjunct senior fellow at the East-West Center. His research focuses on comparative capitalisms. He's working on a research project that studies the implications of China's international reemergence on the global order. It remains to be seen what happens with the Marriott, Starwood, and the Chinese investor Anbang. But meanwhile, the plans to build that 350-foot, 213-unit condo hotel on the site of King's Village and two adjoining Waikiki properties, that'll be heard by the Honolulu City Council Zoning Committee today.
Good morning, I'm Jesse Littman from Kokua Kalihi Valley. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
In December of 1943, two surfers paddled out at Sunset Beach in moderate conditions. But those were the days before modern surf forecasting, and fast-moving swells could move in without warning. On this particular day, the manageable 10-foot waves quickly became larger, forcing the two men far offshore to avoid them. Seeing that it would be impossible to make it back to land from where they were, the imperiled pair decided to paddle 2 miles down the coast to Waimea Bay, hoping the deeper waters there would provide safer passages to shore. When the surfers arrived at Waimea, they found it to be completely closed out as well and saw little hope for safely negotiating the paddle to shore. As Woody Brown would later tell it, his friend waited for a lull in the sets and then feverishly attempted to make it to shore. A large set loomed on the horizon and broke right on top of the man. Dickie Cross was never seen again, and his death was responsible for what some called the Waimea taboo. His friend Woody Brown survived to tell the tale, but it would be almost 15 years before someone attempted to surf Waimea Bay again. And no one got the answer today, but at 8:47, that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
A good poem gains from being read again and again and doesn't need to mean the same thing in every reading or to every reader. It's language crafted with a heightened attention to detail and an awareness of its music. Jane Hirschfield is one of America's most acclaimed poets. She's on Maui to read from her work and talk about it at a Merwin Conservancy Green Room event this weekend, and she's on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Jane.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
My pleasure.
I've been reading through your work and just, you know, how when you read a poet's work, certain phrases kind of jump out at you. But I've also noticed that as I go back to something I've read 20 minutes earlier, it resonates a little differently. That's okay, isn't it?
Well, it's more than okay. Every time you read a poem, you're a slightly different person.
That's true. Yeah, good point. A lot of people, I mean, in some ways, poetry seems to me one of the less understood of the arts, and a lot of people are hesitant to delve into it. You've addressed that in some of your work, haven't you?
Well, in my books about poetry, the most recent one is 10 Windows, I try to unlock the keys, and one of the unlocking the keys is to get rid of the sense that a poetry is, in fact, a puzzle that has a correct answer.
Yeah.
It isn't.
Yeah.
Poems face in many, many different directions, and any response you have to one when you read it is actually the correct response.
Yeah. But that's not universally understood, is it, Jane?
No, and I think people get frightened of poems, but really, if a person hasn't been reading poetry much and wants to start, just read it as if it was normal sentences and hear it with mm-hmm. your listening ear, with your listening heart. A poem is the inner murmur of one person's thoughts and feeling and images made available to others.
And as we look at our own inner murmurings, we often speak to ourselves in what you could call poetic language because we understand it. It's us talking, right?
Well, yes. Everybody dreams and everybody creates language which could be a poem if they wanted it to be.
That's I wish more people knew that, but that's something you're going to be talking about with people on Maui this weekend, yeah?
Yeah, mostly what I'm doing, since it's a Merwin Conservancy reading, which has an ecological background to it.
Sure.
I'm going to be reading a lot of poems which speak to our relationship with the natural world, our deeply imperiled, permeable, glorious, ecstatic relationship with the world that the human world touches.
There's a line from one of your poems. I just sort of jotted down a few lines that for one reason or other jumped out at me. And one of them is, I'll just read it, the way a brown pelican runs out of anchovy glitter at darkfall. Here's what I like. Here's what I liked about that line: the use of darkfall rather than nightfall. Nightfall being the more obvious word, darkfall being the more expressive word. Yeah.
Yeah, and to say something in a way that it isn't always said wakes up the inner heart, spirit, listener, psyche. That the language of poetry is a little unusual is one way that what it's asking for is a heightened attention and a broader attention, the attention of the heart, the attention of the mind, the attention of the spirit. And just changing one word, and thank you for noticing that, is enough to be a kind of bell. I don't know if you can hear this. I'm going to try. There's this lovely bell right next to the borrowed phone I'm using. I'm going to try to ring it for you.
Okay. That is some bell.
Isn't that beautiful? It's a small Japanese temple bell. And when I walked into the room and saw it, I couldn't help but ring it. And so now I've done it for your listeners.
It sounded almost electronic, but it wasn't. No.
It's a beautiful brass bull bell. And that, the effect of that, depending on how it came across on the air, is the effect we want poems to have in people's lives.
Well, it jangled our ears, I'll tell you.
Well, jangled, it was a little richer than that in person.
I imagine.
Maybe I held the phone too
close. But, you know, it passed through several electronic media, so you have to expect a certain amount of degradation. One of the things that I think about poem, I'm going back to a conversation I had with a journalist many years ago who just flat out said to my shock, I don't understand poetry. I don't get it. And I had, 30 seconds to try to sell poetry to him. And what I said was, when there's something that you find really difficult to understand, chances are there's a poem that can help you understand it. And I'm talking about epical events in life, things that are just defy our understanding. You think that's fair?
I think that is the very heart of what poems mean for me. Poems are the way that you can face into what is so unnavigable and complicated and many direction facing that there's almost no way to stand in its presence and allow the world to go forward except through poetry. That's what art does for us. Art is the way that we can address the unsolvable problem and feel for a moment, not that it's necessarily solved, but that we're able to go forward.
Maybe we're a little less helpless, yeah?
Yeah, and we're a little more accompanied because one of the subliminal experiences of reading a poem that speaks to your own circumstance is you know that someone else has been there and survived it, been able to write about it.
Which is, in the broader sense, is the power of art.
Yes,
right?
Exactly
the
so.
Catharsis, a kind of cleansing, a kind of and comfort at the same time.
Mm-hmm. A way to face the unfaceable and say, yes, this too is a part of my life.
And yet, whenever you use the word comfort about a work of art, it implies complacency and, stagnancy. But it's not. There's another kind of comfort that comes from being part of a community, doesn't there?
That's right. And poems are, if anything, anti-complacent. They don't let you settle on. Sentimentality is the easy out.
Yeah.
Poetry is the accurate way through. Not out, but through. So that you feel your life with more intensity, with more ability to be permeable to what's actually happening and awake to what's actually happening. It's not a hypnosis. It's a call to presence, a summoning.
It's kind of what happens after the hypnosis is over, right? When the hypnotist snaps his fingers and says, okay, wake up.
Right, exactly. And our whole culture, so much of mass media is about a kind of hypnotic trance, about a fall into a shared narrative or an amusing story or things that put us to sleep and make us maybe more comfortable but less human.
The comfort of cliches, Jane?
Yeah.
Thank you so much for taking the time. It was really great to talk to you. I appreciate it.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
Poet Jane Hirschfield will speak this Saturday at the next installment of The Green Room, an environmental and literary salon series on Maui, sponsored by the Merwin Conservancy. It's in the McCoy Theater at the Maui Arts and Cultural Center. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. And Jane Hirschfield's most recent 8th book of poetry is The Beauty, published by Alfred Knopf.
Hello, Michael Titterton here. On-air fundraisers, it seems to me, are like bagpipes. You either love them or you hate them. There's no in-between. Personally, I love them both. Bagpipes because of the swirl and the swagger. On-air fundraisers because of what they produce once they're over. 6 months of high-quality public radio programming. Not as romantic as bagpipes, perhaps, but still a reason to swell with pride. And yes, we have one coming up, starting next Wednesday.
And there are a lot of other people who are also swelling with pride because of the opening of Tutu Burt's House this morning, which will be a great place for people who are coming out of hospital and homeless and needing a place to truly recuperate.
Addressing a problem that has really kind of fallen into a gap until now, yeah?
Well, right, because what happens, and we all know when we take somebody home from the hospital, there's that aftercare, and Jerry Coffey was right this morning that, you know, if we go home, we usually have help with that.
Yeah.
But for someone who is homeless and alone, there is no help. So perhaps for these 8 lucky people who go in and out of those beds that are now being made available, that partnership with Queens will work very well to keep them well and not going back to the ER.
Yeah, because, well, hospitals can, the way they're structured now, can only deal with the severe problem at the time, and aftercare has sort of fallen into a gap for many people. Yeah?
And now, hopefully not for at least a few people who will be coming out of, or going into and coming out of Tutu Burt's House. So congratulations to everyone who made that one happen. And we will see you tomorrow morning and talk about some other issues on our agenda. White County Check-In with Mayor Carvalho.
And we're looking ahead to the Ko'olau Writers Workshop.
We like to hear from you, and you can call our talk back line anytime you like to leave us your comments in your own voice with your name, please, and the city from which you're calling. Our number is 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
And recordings of past shows are available under The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. I'll see you later tonight for Town Square, and we'll both be back tomorrow for more of The Conversation. See you then.